As a climate scientist, Heidi Roof knows it's time to stop arguing and get realistic about how we can tackle climate change where we live.
You don't have to travel far from home to see the real consequences of climate change unfold around us.
Culinary historian Sarah Lohman shows us an interesting side of American history reflected in the foods we grow and eat. You can start in an apple orchard.
You know, we went from thousands and thousands of varieties to now maybe a dozen.
British guides offer tips for visiting Shakespeare's home at Stratford-upon-Avon.
See it in the morning, see it in the afternoon. It's a lot quieter, and it's a really nice town.
And hear how a love of Shakespeare helped to address the conflicts in South Sudan.
It was an experience which allowed a lot of different South Sudanese tribes to come on stage and to do something together.
Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Heirloom foods that we might take for granted and the agricultural practices that bring them to us. They're at risk in all corners of America. In just a bit, a culinary historian explains what's being done today to preserve local food traditions. A few years ago, a literature professor from Cambridge went to South Sudan. What he encountered was part detective story and a Swahili version of fame. He lets us in on the surprising influence of Shakespeare in East Africa a little later in the hour. We'll also check in with British tour guides with tips for visiting Shakespeare's hometown of Stratford-upon-Avon. Let's start the hour with climate scientist Heidi Roop. She's traveled to all seven continents to be an eyewitness to the growing impacts of climate change on the local environment and to learn what people are trying to do to lessen its impacts. Heidi, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Thanks, Rick.
So in your travels, and you've had to travel because of your work, you've seen that climate change is here. What have you actually seen in your travels that makes it apparent?
So many things. I guess perhaps a reason why I'm a climate scientist is that I really love observing the world. And I have had the great privilege of being able to spend time in places like Greenland and Antarctica. Of course, the Arctic is one of the fastest warming parts of our planet. And it is really difficult to deny climate change when you stand on the toe of a glacier that you know has profoundly changed, not even in 20 years, but in 2 years. And so I have had the privilege and now I think the responsibility to start talking about solutions because I have seen the impacts of climate change. And I think it's important to know that you don't have to travel far from home or even leave your backyard to see the real consequences of climate change unfold around us. Science shows that climate change is everywhere.
Well, what an ethical person you are. You had the privilege, therefore the responsibility. Now, standing on the top of Greenland and seeing and listening to raging rivers, which should be frozen ice, that is, I'm sure, a powerful experience. But even those of us who go on vacation, wherever we go, even for privileged people who are wishing they could do a little summer skiing, you know, or somebody who's meeting vintners in Italy who are all in crisis, even in these first world problem zones, we see what's happening. And in my work, not as a climate specialist, but just as somebody interested in economic realities south of the border, it seems particularly poignant to me how it is the developing countries that are going to suffer far more than the wealthy countries. And for us to not have a vivid understanding of what is their reality, a farmer who no longer can use his soil because it's all washed away because the rain comes all in the same week instead of the same season, it's heartbreaking.
Absolutely, it's heartbreaking. And I think there's an option, right? It's close our ears and close our eyes or open them wide and confront the reality and then identify how you're going to be part of that solution. And some of that honestly calls for really difficult decisions and trade-offs. And I think a reminder that for many of the folks you just spoke about, they are not the source of the problem. And that's the other part of the responsibility piece. We know that a very few of us have created most of the problem of climate change. And so we also need to be thinking about what is the burden of our responsibility. And maybe instead of burden, what is the opportunity that stems from assuming some responsibility?
Exactly. It's an opportunity to make the world livable for our grandchildren. That's an opportunity. As you travel, tell me some ways that you've been inspired by what other governments are doing, because, you know, while their economies might be smaller than ours, they're doing some pretty impressive things, and it sure gets me kind of amped up about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are so many examples from what individual farmers and community members are doing to support local economies that are also sustainable and supporting all different facets of a community to be economically viable, right? We know that's a central ingredient to a climate smart future. I've also seen local governments not deny the existence of climate change and work to the best of their ability to confront challenges like sea level rise. I lived in New Zealand for many years for my dissertation research. The country of New Zealand is a leader in sea level rise preparedness and grappling with the real costs. We think sea level rise will go up for at least the next 1,500 years. So the imperative to prepare is not really up for debate. We have to confront the reality that our coastal communities are going to be living a different future and already are.
This is kind of fundamental. A government that actually acknowledges that it exists is sort of sadly comical to think there's some governments that actually are still discussing that. It's not comical at all. It's tragic. Speaking of that, how important is United States policy and leadership on a global scale? Can the world do it without us?
I don't think the world can lead on climate without any of us. We need all of the countries doing what it is they can at the scale they can to contribute. But there's no question we are not showing the same amount of leadership as we could, proportional to the problem and proportional to the opportunity that we have. This is changing through investments like the Inflation Reduction Act. It's an imperfect tool, but a powerful tool that really is focused on helping the United States transition primarily to renewable energies, but also stand up industries that are going to help us sort of address these last mile solutions. Mm-hmm. So deploying technologies that will enable us to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. But there's no question we need leadership from every country.
And other nations are doing impressive things. There are entire communities that are on the verge of being wind powered now, and entire fjords that don't have any fossil driven boats anymore. And there are entire cities that public transportation is all green powered. These are inspirations. These are good news. And you wonder, why can't we do that?
You wonder why. I mean, maybe we need to hear those stories more. And I feel like nothing lights a fire like competition in the United States. So yeah. I feel like, you know, we've got to start elevating those stories and say, you know, we've got better tidal energy than, of course, we all have the same tidal energy, but
light a fire on our competitive selves.
Yes,
you know,
that's
like
right.
A Tesla is almost a budget car in Norway because of government policies. There are so many advantages you get when you own an electric car in Norway. We could do that. It's kind of fun that other people are innovating and we can all compare notes. Dr. Heidi Roop is with us today on Travel with Rick Steves as an eyewitness to the impacts of climate change around the world. She teaches climate science at the University of Minnesota and directs the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. Heidi's written the Climate Action Handbook to recommend 100 practical ways that you and I can address its effects in our homes and communities. She offers more ideas on her website, HeidiRoop.com, spelled R-O-O-P. One thing that's interesting for me as a tour operator, Heidi, is I wanted to have a tour company that is carbon neutral. And I was very frustrated in trying to find ways to buy carbon offsets because I just felt like everybody had a profit motive. I didn't want to make some company in the United States even stronger and wealthier with my philanthropic investment or whatever. And then I learned, because I read a book called Drawdown by Paul Hawken. It's 6 years old. And I learned that I think something like half of the people on the planet are smallholder farmers in the developing world. And people in the poor world are contributing to climate change just like people in the rich world, but they don't have the luxury in a lot of cases of consuming less travel or something like that. They're just trying to survive. And with their farming practices, they are doing things that are not climate smart. And one way that we can kind of help mitigate our carbon is to invest in these societies so that they can do their work in a climate smart way that is both more productive and less costly from a carbon point of view. For instance, if you're a desperate farmer in a very poor part of the world living off the grid, you have to scavenge a lot of firewood just to feed your family, keep people warm, and cook your food. If you had a stove that actually was a smart stove with a chimney and so on, you'd need half the firewood, and that would be half the deforestation, and your family would be more healthy. And that's a very small investment. It's just a little technological help. Does that make any sense to you when you're looking for a way that mitigation is for real?
I think it does, yes. And I haven't done the exact math, but I think the premise is the right one, right? Mm-hmm. In that I think investing in real people doing real things, I think often that are put in systems that are maybe out of their control or are modifying systems in order to compete, right? There are some really tough realities of systems that often stem from the ones that we are creating and upholding. And so I think there really is that deep reflection on, you know, what is it that I'm investing in? And can I verify that it's being done? I think that's a really big, sticky piece of all of this is by investing in people, I think we have better confidence that what we're investing in is translating into the benefits and more, right? It's not just emissions bean counting, right? This is transforming lives and local economies and investing in education. The challenge and opportunity potentially for you, Rick, is to think about what are the other benefits that stem from these investments and how can you tell those stories? Because
yeah, that's what I
know
love.
Very
it's a
clearly.
Twofer. It's a
yeah,
twofer.
It's a, and maybe a more. I don't know what the what's a threefer or
it's
a fourfer, right? And so I think it's telling that story, thinking about the co-benefits. And this came clearly in my book, and I have to remind myself this every day. Facts and figures don't change hearts and minds, but people do.
So it really is. It's an awareness raising challenge.
Yes, and empowering people to act.
We've got to wire ourselves to celebrate that kind of thinking. You know, this is a new sensibility, and it has to be a broad thing instead of the silver bullet, right?
Yes, I completely agree. And I think there's just so much opportunity. And the last action in my book, everyone asks me, what's the one action? There isn't one, because the path is your own. We need to invite more people to be part of the solution and find their own way through this. But the last action, action 100, is gratitude. Mm. We like to talk about the problem. We like to talk about how there's not enough being done, not enough people care. Nobody's talking about it. We're not doing anything. And I like to say you can throw a rock and hit someone who's doing something good, probably for the place you live and also for climate. And we need to extend gratitude and acknowledge those behaviors we want to see more of. We know clinical psychology, humans are predictable. We love to be thanked and acknowledged for the things that we're doing. If we can start acknowledging the solution in addition to the realities of the problem, I think we're going to get a lot closer to where we want to go.
All right. Dr. Heidi Roop, the book is The Climate Action Handbook. Thank you for 100 climate solutions that any of us can do. Best wishes.
Thank you.
They're celebrating Shakespeare Day in the UK, and we're just in time for the Bard's 460th birthday. We'll put a little Shakespeare into your travels in just a bit. But first, a culinary historian alerts us to agricultural traditions that are at risk of disappearing from the American landscape, from the Carolina Lowcountry in Hawaii to the upper Midwest, Pacific Northwest, and desert Southwest. Sarah Lohman takes us to apple orchards, desert date farms, and fields of wild rice and sugarcane. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. There are hundreds of plants, animals, and food traditions that are actually disappearing from America's food repertoire. When you look at a list of endangered foods in America, you might be surprised to find the apple is at the top of the list. Culinary historian Sarah Lohman has traveled across the U.S. to investigate what food can teach us about history and culture and to see what happens when those foods start to disappear. She profiles the people she met and how their stories are connected to 8 different foods we risk losing in the near future in her book called Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. Sarah joins us now from her home in Las Vegas to tell us what we can find and do to preserve the nation's culinary legacy. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Rick.
You know, you've got a cool job. What it seems like, but I've really never thought of what does a culinary historian actually do?
while I use the history of food to tell stories about the history of humanity. And personally, I like to focus on American history because I think that our history is very complicated. Our cultural population is extremely diverse. And I think that food is both a very clear way to understand that history and the contemporary. But also, I found that when people are eating, they're more empathetic and they're more open to discussing sometimes difficult topics, too. So history via eating.
You know, and I've always thought, you know, the best way to understand a culture or a nation is to go to the museums and so on. But you can also go to the hearth, to the kitchen table, and learn through the cuisine. And I love to connect with people who have found their niche. And if you look back on your personal history, just it's sort of like you're in the right spot. And I understand you grew up in a small town in Ohio, Hinckley.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And what was your first job?
My first job that my mom told me I had to get was working at a living history museum, which is like maybe someone has been to Williamsburg or Plymouth Plantation. So we were in costume, in character, on like a fairly large site. And I worked in a house that had a working wood fire stove. We did mid-19th century and worked from period culinary resources. And the ability to read these historical documents and create something real and experiential and flavorful and delicious,
nice,
or not delicious, really affected me.
So, and then at that point, I guess you realized, well, this is kind of a good fit for me. And then as at university, you had an undergraduate thesis that related to this as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So I went to art school, and for this thesis, I opened what today we'd call a pop-up restaurant. So it was a functioning restaurant for 4 days that served colonial era food to contemporary audience. And I realized in school that I kept coming back to this interpretation of history, right? And so it came out through food.
Now, somebody that goes back to that same era, who we all know and love from our childhood, is Johnny Appleseed.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, he was kind of a neighbor of yours in small town Ohio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's your take on Johnny Appleseed? Because 2024 is the 250th anniversary of his birth.
Oh, wow. Well, honestly, he was kind of a weird dude. I'm not going to lie. He's one of those iconic American characters that his real life story has gotten really mixed up with the myth of him, too. But he sort of was, honestly, he was a capitalist. He was buying land in like the new Ohio Territory dirt cheap. And interestingly, one of the like laws said that if you plant an orchard, then the land is considered improved and is worth more money. So he was buying the land, walking through it, spreading the seeds, and then selling the land, you know, 10 or 20 years later at a much higher rate. The man died. I mean, we don't know how much money he had, but probably a millionaire or a billionaire by today's standards.
Jeez, I just thought he was some little hippie that liked apples, but he was actually he was increasing the value of his land by planting apples on it.
He was also anti-shoes, so he also was kind of a hippie, too. He's just, there was a lot going on there. But allegedly, now I haven't been to visit this, in southern Ohio, a couple of the trees he planted still exist.
Wow.
And he is credited with originating the red delicious apple, which I know some people are like, oh, I wish he hadn't at this point.
Uh-huh.
But 100 years ago, red delicious tasted quite different. So that was one of his sort of original varieties that grew from an apple seed he planted.
Well, this is a nice segue into the topic of your book, Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. And as I mentioned, apples are on the top. Would Johnny Appleseed would be, I would imagine, kind of concerned about that if he was around right now. First of all, what's the story with apples? And how can that be that something that is so omnipresent is actually endangered?
Well, okay, maybe a question for you. When you go into the grocery store, how many apple varieties do you think you see there?
I think 6 or 8 or 10, I suppose.
Okay. So in the early 20th century, the government published a book about all of the American apple varieties, and it counted 17,000 unique varieties. So, and, you know, some of them they think are repeats, but, you know, we went from thousands and thousands of varieties to now maybe a dozen in the grocery store. Now, a lot of that shift came because America got away from cider drinking, both from the temperance movement in the middle of the 19th century and then Prohibition. And many of those thousands of lost apples were cider making apples. They weren't really good for eating off the tree. So that was sort of the main thing where we lost all those thousands of varieties. Now there are teams of people that are specifically, you know, looking at land maps, you know, looking for the clues and going out and trying to find trees that have survived the last century. that they can use to repopulate varieties that were thought to be extinct.
Okay, so we're not losing the apple as we know it. We're losing varieties of the apple. Is that right?
Ooh, I mean, that's an interesting way to talk about it, though, because when we think about a Red Delicious was very much selectively bred for a grocery store. What grocery stores traditionally have looked for is appearance and sweetness. And that's what you get with a Red Delicious. But is a Red Delicious actually delicious in the 21st century?
See, that's interesting. I remember talking at Washington State. My state is great on apples.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You can go to an apple convention or whatever, and it's more about how does it look than how does it taste, which I think goes against the sensibilities of Europeans, for example. They're happy with ugly fruit as long as it's tasty.
A lot of orchardists are also very frustrated by that idea. They want to make good-tasting apples, and that has begun to shift. Actually, where the Red Delicious was America's favorite or best-selling apple for a long time, now it's the Gala apple. So we've started to move to varieties that are a little firmer, crunchier, have a little more acid, and are a little more complicated.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Sarah Lohman. We're looking at the historic and indigenous foods in the United States, starting with apples, and foods that are at risk of being lost. Her book is Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. She's also the author of a book called Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. You can find out more about Sarah and her work as a culinary historian at her website. It's sarahlohman.com. That's L-O-H-M-A-N. So, Sarah, let's talk about these foods. In your book, you highlight different cases for food that we should be tuned into. Dates, sugarcane, churro sheep, salmon, wild rice, cider apples, gumbo made from a certain Choctaw filet powder, and Carolina Africa runner peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story behind each of these. There's a reason they're here. There's a reason we care about them. And there's a reason that they are threatened. Can we just highlight a few of these? Like if you take dates, for example.
Yeah.
What's the news with dates as they try to struggle in the 21st century?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people will be shocked to know that the Coachella Valley, now famous for the Coachella Festival, at the turn of the century was known as America's like date garden. It was full of family farms growing unique varieties of dates because the climate there is extremely similar to the Arabian Peninsula. It's very hot and there's not a lot of rain, but there is a lot of underground water. Huh. So there are dates still for sale there that you can't find anywhere else. They were uniquely created in California. But, you know, as the generations kind of moved on, maybe the kids or grandkids didn't want to take up date farming. So a lot of that property was either sold or they produce a couple standardized dates for Dole. So date palms, they have a very limited amount of time where you can propagate them, where you can cut off shoots and grow basically copies of the same date. So if a date palm variety is one of the old American ones and it is too old to take cuttings from, that's it. It's gone. So we're losing small family farms, essentially.
So this is a case where the United States decided, hey, dates are cool. They grow in the Middle East. Here's a place where the environment's conducive to that. So they imported them, and we had a little industry there a long time ago. And now in the modern age, there's just an economic reality. The younger generation is interested in doing things other than raising dates, and that's a food variety that might be in crisis. So another example would be a certain kind of sugarcane in Hawaii.
Yeah, we're talking specifically about heirloom Hawaiian sugar cane. And so this is cane that was brought with the Polynesian wayfinders who first settled Hawaii. We're talking about 1,000 years ago. So there are so many beautiful varieties of sugar cane in Hawaii that both taste and look very, very different. And a lot of that was reduced because of the monocropping of the sugar industry that was there for a long time. And now the biggest risk is housing. You know, land is being bought and sold and houses are being built there. And so any of the sort of remaining, like ancestral sugar cane, might just be raised and cleared out. So increasing awareness is important there.
This is a great, these are just case studies in the rise and fall of different foods. And it's such a cool thing that you highlight them with individual chapters in your book. But another topic that you focus on is churro sheep. Tell us the story of these sheep.
Yeah, I love these sheep. So they are a sheep that belong to the Navajo or Diné people. in the American Southwest. And they have been sort of the animal partners of the Diné for the last 400 or 500 years. They're very selectively bred to survive in the difficult climate of the Southwest. They're great foragers and mothers, and their wool is made into the famous Navajo blankets, as well as the taste of their meat is really important to, like, the feeling of home for Diné people.
And so what is the crisis for these sheep now?
Where's the rub? So the first time was when the Navajo were pushed onto a different reservation. And as one of the techniques to sort of terrorize the Diné people, the sheep were slaughtered. And then the second time was in the 1930s when it was thought that the land was being overgrazed and that would build silt up behind Hoover Dam. And so the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and killed literally millions of animals and also began breeding the sheep with breeds of sheep they thought would be more profitable, but didn't survive as well in the Southwest.
And that's not a unique thing to the United States. I was just at the new museum in Oslo and the National Museum. And in the lobby, there's a wall that's filled with the skulls of reindeers, each with a bullet hole in the middle of their forehead. Mm. And it's a powerful piece of modern art in solidarity with the Sami people way up in the north, the indigenous people in the north for whom reindeer is their livelihood. Mm-hmm. But the government decided things were overbred or there was too many of them. And they went on this campaign of killing, millions of reindeer, just like you're talking about with these sheep. Mm-hmm. So that is another dynamic that can get in the way of the continued existence of a food that at least a segment of the population knows and loves.
Food historian Sarah Lohmans, our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. She's written Endangered Eating to alert us to a growing number of plants, animals, and food traditions that are vanishing from America and how we can prevent losing them. She's also the author of 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. She offers recipes with her newsletter at sarahlohmans.com.
Tell us about the news on the salmon front.
Oh, so very important to Washington State, right? So, of course, there's big conversations about salmon and how to preserve them. And Lummi Island Wild believes that the answer to that is to return to an indigenous fishing method called reef net or shwala. These are stationary platforms. They use no fossil fuels. And basically, they place a net in front of a salmon run and wait for the salmon to swim in the net. The fish are pulled aboard live into a live well, and so any protected species of salmon can be pulled out and safely returned to the water. So it's incredibly sustainable. And I think most importantly here, we're focusing on expansion. It does exist still off of Lummi Island, but also returning this tradition to indigenous people and giving them the resources to be able to build their own reef net gears and return to the fishing that was really key to their identity.
You know, each one of these episodes, it's got its own plot, its own story, its own characters. I think as you did your research, you probably met some interesting people. We haven't yet talked about wild rice or gumbo or the peanuts, but can you think of we don't have time to talk about all of these, but
yeah.
Can you think of an example of a personality that comes to mind that sort of makes the whole thing more vivid and easy to get your brain around? Who inspired you from all the people you met?
Yeah. Let's talk about maybe Nat Bradford from the Carolina African Runner peanut. These are North America's first peanut, and they were believed to be extinct in the 1930s. But a couple years ago, someone found 24 peanuts in cold storage. I know. And like they needed, and they were grown out. And so they're trying to get them back up to a modern day crop. Nat was a farmer who worked specifically with heirloom foods. Sometimes it's just a packet of seeds given to him by an old timer of their family's crop that goes back generations. But he's having a hard time, building out crops like the peanut to a commercial level because there really is no, you need financial support. It takes years to get something up to commercial level. So we stood in his field and talked about all the things that he came up against when he's trying to basically repatriate these heirloom crops.
And knowing him probably makes you all of a sudden a fan of peanuts.
I mean, they are probably the most incredible peanuts I've ever tasted. Really, really. They're like the truffles of peanuts, both in their flavor and their rarity at this point.
We're exploring American food legacies right now that are worth preserving. And we're talking with Sarah Lohman here on Travel with Rick Steves. She's the author of Endangered Eating. Her book explores 8 vanishing foods, and we've just talked about 5 or 6 of them, from different regions around the United States, and the stories and the histories that are connected to each of these foods.
Sarah is a culinary historian. She works with institutions around the country to create public programs focused on food. You can connect with Sarah on Facebook and Instagram. We'll have links to Sarah in our show notes, or you can just Google Sarah Lohman, L-O-H-M-A-N. Sarah, I want to close with this wonderful idea you have, eat it to save it.
Oh, I can't take credit for it. That is Slow Food International that coined that phrase. That is their very simple sort of charge for us on how we preserve these going extinct foods. A lot of times you eat it to save it.
Because if nobody's going to eat it, nobody's going to stock it on the shelves and nobody cares. And then it's the monocrop mm-hmm. that gets up there in a big bag for a good mm-hmm. price. And I know my friends in Italy who are so enthusiastic about the slow food movement, they really believe in the ethics of going with the flow, eating with the seasons, eating locally, having a 0 kilometer meal. And you get tastier food and you get more sustainable food and it's more, farm to table. So tell me, if you're going to eat it to save it, you're not going to choke down bad food. What's something that I know that you even include some recipes in the book?
Yeah.
What's a favorite recipe of yours? Just to close our conversation out, tell us about a recipe with one of these ingredients that just makes your mouth water to describe it.
Well, let's go back to dates in my first chapter, because although sure have a local meal, but you can also order these Coachella Valley dates online. And so you can have these unique dates in your home. And then you probably want to make a recipe included from Rawan El Khatib. And it is so good. It's basically dates fried in butter. And you pour those over ricotta that's on focaccia. And you can top the whole thing with honey and chili flakes. And then you just put it down on the table and let everybody tear in. It's wonderful.
I was getting excited just listening to you describe that.
I'm Sarah, hungry now.
I know. Sarah Lohman, thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us and best wishes raising awareness of endangered eating.
Thank you so much.
You can find web links to our guests in the notes we post with each week's show. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. It includes a link to Sarah Lohman's earlier appearance with us when she highlighted what's been on the typical American table for Thanksgiving over the last 400 years. We've got suggestions for touring Shakespeare's birthplace in England and for finding the influence of the bard's works in what might seem to be an unlikely setting in the deserts of South Sudan. That's all just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. As the most important playwright in the world, the works of William Shakespeare have been translated into just about every language on earth. In just a bit, we'll hear about Shakespeare's influence in East Africa. Right now, let's get advice for touring Shakespeare's home turf at Stratford-upon-Avon. We're joined by British tour guides Gillian Chadwick and Roy Nichols.
Good to see
you're
you, Rick.
You're welcome.
Gillian, what's your take from a guide's point of view on Stratford? Is it worth the trouble?
I think Shakespeare is so important to the whole English experience, and the opportunity to go and see a play in one of the theatres in Stratford-upon-Avon shouldn't be missed.
Because that's the home of the Royal Shakespeare Company,
isn't it?
It's
the home of the Royal Shakespeare Company. You've got world-class actors, great places to eat and to stay, and there's beautiful countryside around Stratford-upon-Avon. You can go on boat trips. Plenty to do there.
So it is worth having a base there and enjoying a play or two in the evenings.
Definitely.
And seeing the town and side-tripping from there even.
Definitely, yeah.
Roy, what's your advice on enjoying the town itself?
Well, it's going to be busy if you're there at the main part of the season. So do the obvious things if you can. Travel on the shoulder seasons, early in the year, later in the year. Go early, stay late. Most people go there just for the day. They'll spend a couple of hours. The big tourist buses go in for a couple of hours. People have lunch and go. See it in the morning, see it in the afternoon. It's a lot quieter, and it's a really nice town.
That's true, because during the middle of the day, it feels like it's a nice shell packed with just flash-in-the-pan tourists. They're coming
for a long walk.
Yeah, leave the middle of the day. Because a lot of people are just hell-bent on going to Stratford, but they don't want to not sleep in London, so they drive out a couple of hours, spend the middle of the day there, and drive home. That would be the time to take a walk.
It really is. And the difference between seeing Stratford later in the evening or first thing in the morning is huge.
Now, the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust runs different sites associated with Shakespeare. Gillian, talk about these sites, just briefly. Which ones are worth the trouble?
Well, the most visited, of course, is the birthplace.
Uh-huh.
You see where he was actually born. And there's a museum surrounding the house. My favourite is Anne Hathaway's cottage. and Anne Hathaway was his wife, obviously, and you go and visit the place where he used to court her. And it's a beautiful cottage, thatched cottage.
I think I would agree with you because, of course, you got to see the birthplace, and which is sort of just designed for thousands of people to sort of like a big long line go through the place. But it is connected to a very nice museum that tells the story quite well, right in the center of town. And then we have Anne Hathaway's cottage a little bit outside of town with a delightful English garden.
Yep.
And docents there and guides there that will give you all sorts of intimate, quirky little insights into life during Shakespeare's time. Roy, what are the other sites and would they even matter compared to the birthplace and Anne Hathaway's
I think
cottage?
Gillian's made the point that the ones that you really want to see, there is new place in Stratford itself, and that was the house that William Shakespeare built to live in once he'd retired away from London. But that's a ruin. Mm. So I would really focus on doing the Birthplace Trust Museum and going out to Anne Hathaway's cottage. There's a bus that goes out there. It's very easy to get out to and really just focus on those two.
Now, I remember there's like a combo ticket where you buy a ticket to all the Shakespeare-related sites,
yes,
or you can buy just the birthplace. But if you're going to see two or three sites, you might as well buy that combo ticket, and then you can pop into all of them. They're just a few blocks apart, except for Anne Hathaway's cottage, which is a little bit outside of town. Roy, if you're a Shakespeare theater buff, tell me what you can see at the theater apart from going to a play.
Well, they do the museum tour, the theater tours. Mm-hmm. So you can take one of those when they're not obviously got a play on or they're not rehearsing. And if you're a Shakespeare fan, then really do make the effort to try and get a ticket for a play beforehand.
And I would imagine they have matinees also.
They do. And remember, there's at least two theatres in Stratford itself that they can go to. There's the main theatre and there's the other place.
The Swan.
The Swan.
Yeah.
Perhaps more contemporary at the Swan.
So, and this is the Royal Shakespeare Company. You can make a case that's the best Shakespeare in the world.
Yeah, definitely.
Does it split its season between London and Stratford, or is it all at Stratford, do you know?
It does come to London in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the season at Stratford runs through till the end of September, early October, and then that's the, as Gillian says, that's when they decant to the capital.
Now, if you're into Shakespeare and you don't have time to go out to Stratford, when you're in London, you can visit the Globe Theatre.
Yes.
Roy, can you explain what the Globe Theatre is all about?
The Globe Theatre is a replica of the original theatre, not on the same site, it was a few hundred yards away. But in the 1980s, the American actor who had come to Britain during the 50s because of the McCarthy period was the great inspiration about rebuilding Shakespeare's Globe Theatre. He couldn't understand why something like that didn't exist, and he spent decades trying to get support to build it. And then finally, sadly after his death, it was opened to really celebrate the great plays of Shakespeare.
And Gillian, what is unique about the Globe Theatre? It's not just any theatre.
Oh, it's open air.
Just like it was in Shakespeare's
just
time.
Like it's constructed on the lines of the original theatre. So it's you're around the stage.
So it's theatre in the sort of around?
In the round. And to really be part of the performance, you are a penny stinker.
What does that mean?
Well, in Shakespeare's day, you paid a penny and the poor people stunk. So you were called a penny stinker.
So there was always accommodation made for the poor people. Get in for a penny.
That's right, yeah.
And that would be just like on the ground in front of the stage.
Yep. Yeah.
So there'd be seats for the more fancy people.
They paid two pennies to be in the galleries.
Because I've always heard of these, what do you call them, penny stinkers?
Penny stinkers.
Is it the same as groundlings?
And groundlings.
Groundlings.
Yes.
And the cool thing about that is to this day, for $5 or $10, you can get a penny stinker ticket.
Yep.
And actually put your elbows on the stage and be right there, like involved in the whole theater as the penny stinkers would have been 500 years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. In fact, it's a good tip is to get a gallery seat so you get comfort, but do go down at some stage to be with the groundlings and you'll get a much better experience.
So that's the Globe Theatre in London. But that's not the Royal Shakespeare Company. It's fine theatre. But if you want the Royal Shakespeare Company in the summertime, you'll want to go out to Stratford. And when you're in Stratford, you've got plenty of opportunities to do some sightseeing and enjoy that beautiful part of England.
That's right.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking about Stratford with Gillian Chadwick and Roy Nichols. Gillian and Roy, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You'll find links to Roy and Gillian with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. All the world is indeed a stage for Shakespeare, even in Africa's newest nation. English literature professor Edward Wilson Lee argues that Shakespeare has played a role in the decolonization of Africa. He joins us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives to explore the global poetry of Shakespeare in Swahili land. He grew up in Kenya with American and British parents who worked as conservationists there. Today, Edward Wilson Lee is a professor of literature who teaches Shakespeare at Cambridge. He returned to East Africa to explore how the writings of William Shakespeare have played a defining role in the region from colonial times to the process of establishing new nations. His travels included a stop in Juba, the capital of South Sudan. It's the world's newest nation born out of decades of civil war, but whose challenges are far from over. Edward outlines what he found in his book, Shakespeare in Swahili Land. Edward Wilson Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So tell us a little bit about your love of Shakespeare and your connection with East Africa.
So I grew up in East Africa. I went to boarding school in Switzerland and then university in the United Kingdom. And I fell in love with Shakespeare during my teenage years and at university and ended up teaching that. But I didn't think until I stumbled upon the beginnings of this project that I'd be able to connect these two parts of my life growing up in East Africa. I found the beginnings of the project in this, one of the earliest texts printed in Swahili was a translation of Charles and Mary Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare. So I went out to East Africa, to Zanzibar, to research that, and just found from there that it was a thread I could tug at, and stories just kept coming and coming. And it covers really the whole history of Eastern Africa from the mid-19th century to the present day, and has just an endless cast of colorful characters involved in it.
In your book, Shakespeare in Swahili Land, is a reference to the language that's spoken through most of East Africa. And Sudan just barely makes that terrain. Talk about, just briefly to set the stage, the story of South Sudan. It's been in the news in the last decade.
Yeah, so South Sudan, historically, because of how the British divided the region up during the colonial period and afterwards, had been part of a single country with what is now just known as Sudan. But the northern part of the country is a very Arabic-influenced and Arabic-speaking nation, whereas the southern part is much more Bantu, shares much more with the countries to its south. So South Sudan declared independence from the rest of the country in 2011, and as one of the first acts as a country, South Sudan sent a Shakespeare play performed by a troupe from their capital, Juba, to the Globe to Globe Festival in London in 2012. You know, having spent years looking at the, you know, the mixture between politics and history and culture through the lens of Shakespeare in East Africa, I was dying to see this happening in real time in the world's newest nation in South Sudan. So I went out to meet the man who translated Cymbeline into Juba Arabic.
So you traveled to South Sudan to research your book. Normal tourists don't go to South Sudan, do they? What did you find? What was it like going there? What does it take to go there?
Yeah, it was a pretty unusual experience. You know, the South Sudanese embassy was just a rented office space in a kind of regional part of London. Pretty much everyone else going was an aid worker or someone working for an embassy or an NGO. So when I got there, there was almost no provision for tourists in order to be allowed in the country. In order to get a visa, you had to book into a tourist hotel, but the tourist hotel was essentially shipping containers with beds and air conditioning and satellite TV inside them. Again, you know, largely catering to people who were there working for aid agencies and development agencies. So it certainly wasn't set up for your average tourist. And, you know, Juba is a town with very little infrastructure, very few buildings, more than a story tall, one paved road. And the wounds from the civil war, which had been being fought between the north and the south for decades, were still very fresh. In fact, the only place you could buy a souvenir was a local craft project in which women who had suffered sexual violence during the civil wars made craft products to be sold on.
And you wrote about how it was actually, in spite of how desperately poor the country is, it was quite expensive to hop into a taxi or quite expensive to stay in a hotel.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because in large part, everyone there is on a governmental expense account, usually, because the only travelers are development travelers. So as is so often the case in Africa, when a new nation is being born and aid money is flooding in, there are small operators who are pretty canny at turning up and providing the services, providing taxi rides and hotels, and even there's a dollar supermarket, which had a pretty wide selection of champagne magnums, as long as you're willing to pay in dollars. But for the average South Sudanese, there was very little infrastructure.
Right. Now, do I understand English is the official language of South Sudan?
English is now, yes, is the official language of South Sudan. And in fact, there's an extraordinary Shakespearean story behind that, in that one of the reasons that they chose English to be the official language, it was obviously in part a rejection of Arabic, the Arabic language of the north, which had been the official language of the country from which they had left. But one of the brigadiers in the South Sudanese People's Liberation Army, who was central to making this decision to move to English, fell in love with Shakespeare, a volume of Shakespeare that had been given to him by a missionary when he was fighting as a boy soldier in the civil wars in the 1980s.
Edward Wilson Lee is joining us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives. He writes about the role Shakespeare plays for the people of South Sudan in the years preceding its latest civil war. His book is Shakespeare in Swahili Land. Sadly, since becoming independent in 2011, half the population of South Sudan has been displaced by political violence and by challenges caused by climate change. Edward writes about the Library of World Knowledge that a son of Christopher Columbus established in Sevilla in his book, The Catalogue of Shipwrecked Books. He also wrote A History of Water to explore what 16th century Europeans encountered in India and China. When he's not writing about the Renaissance, Edward teaches Shakespeare at Cambridge. His website is edwardwilsonlee.com. This is one of these countries that is kind of the result of colonial border drawing generations ago, which was ignoring ethnic realities. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Essentially, the British put together two administrative regions for their own convenience, which shared very little in terms of a historic culture. The north is a very Arabic-influenced place with cultural influences from Egypt and the Middle East, whereas the south is filled with, you know, a much more Bantu-influenced culture that looks south.
So if we think of the most desperate, struggling, falling-apart countries, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Sudan, a lot of their problems do go back to careless, selfish colonial line drawing a century ago, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of these places are living through the consequences of decisions that were made a long time ago.
So now we have this bold little country breaking away from the majority of the Sudan because they are ethnically different and they have an affinity for Shakespeare. You know, I would imagine you can take some of the themes of Shakespeare's great plays, swap out a few of the proper nouns, and have something that provides for a communal identity. Is that actually a part of Shakespeare's purpose in South Sudan, is just helping people relate to the struggles they've had with colonial overlords, just like combating forces did centuries ago in Shakespeare's plays?
Yeah, so one of the extraordinary things about this translation of Cymbeline, which is really not a very well-known Shakespeare play, it's not one of the greatest hits, was not only it's a story about the formation of British identity as Britain separates from the Roman Empire. So it's a story of rebellion, the British rebellion against the Roman Empire. So it's really a story that thinks about the violence of war and national identity and the relationship between the two. But in putting this play on, it was also, you know, an experience which allowed a lot of different South Sudanese tribes who had never been able to participate in any kind of joint activity as a nation to come on stage and to do something together. So the production that was put on was intentionally mixing the tribal dresses of all these different tribes and literally enacting a kind of unity that they were still having to work through and still are having to work through in a very real sense in the political domain. But this was creating a story which was a story of nation building and a story that was bringing all of the different parts of South Sudan together. So it was an extraordinary artistic moment.
So could you envision sitting with at a venue filled with enthusiastic locals, watching a Shakespeare play in the local language in South Sudan? What would the scene be like? And I can just imagine the play having been adapted to the cultural struggles of this generation, people just getting into it and whooping it up. What would that be like if you happened to be able to witness that in South Sudan?
Yeah, so they did perform the production many times back in Juba after it had been performed in London. They were largely outdoor performances, although the strangest part of the story is that so central to the early part of South Sudanese identity formation was this play, this Shakespeare play, that there was a plan, it may still be in train, to build a replica of Shakespeare's globe, which you can visit in London, mm-hmm. in Juba, in South Sudan, with slight South Sudanese adaptations. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a production that draws you in. You know, there's this extraordinary moment in Cymbeline when Posthumus, the male hero, is approached by Imogen, the heroine, with whom he is deeply in love, with who he's wronged, but he doesn't recognize her. And he knocks her down and is about to commit violence upon this person who he doesn't recognize. And I think, you know, for a country that has been through so much trauma, this dramatic moment of people reaching such violent states, but then coming to a recognition that actually there is a past, a distant past, in which they shared something and something special and something that united them. So I think there, you know, it's a really striking play in that regard.
Edward Wilson Lee, thanks so much for giving us an insight into the impact of Shakespeare beyond Western culture, specifically in Swahili land. The book, Shakespeare in Swahili Land, In Search of a Global Poet. And Edward, I think you could make a good case that if we had one global poet, could be Shakespeare.
He certainly meant a lot to an awful lot of people. And I think one of the wonderful things about Shakespeare's part in world literary history is that the parts of the world who have adopted him and adapted him are giving him back to the English-speaking world, wholly renewed and changed and in many ways much more interesting.
All right. Great book. And thank you, Edward, so much for being with us, and best wishes with your teaching.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kasmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests, listen to a podcast version of the show, and search the archives at ricksteves.com/radio.
My Facebook friends are a fun community of curious travelers, and you're invited to join in. To stow away with me in my work, play, politics, philanthropy, and travels, follow me at Rick Steves on Facebook.